You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Thank you all for joining us today to have this conversation with two of our Open Society Fellows who have been working on issues related to the private sector and development over the course of the past year and a half or so, 2 years. And both are at the end of their fellowships, and we thought we would take this opportunity to bring them together at a time that we could talk about some of these questions that are also increasingly becoming relevant at OSF and in the context of certainly the Soros Economic Development Fund, Economic Advancement Program, but also more broadly where we're more interested in matters related to development, economics, more broadly. And so I will introduce two of our colleagues, fellows, momentarily, and they will talk a little bit about their projects and what they've been doing for the past year, and then we'll try to unpack some of these broad concepts that we laid out in the invitation, some things that often fall into various buckets and come with a lot of ideological and other kinds of veneers. And I think this might be a chance to sort of dig a little bit deeper. And so with that, I'll get started. So Prashant Sharma is working on a research project that looks at the accountability question around public-private partnerships in education. His focus is primarily India, with initial focuses on South Africa, various countries in Latin America. And there had been an emerging conversation on BRICS countries, but that, I think, is evolving. He's currently based at the UN Research Institute for Social Development in Geneva and also affiliated with the Swiss Graduate School of Public Administration at the University of Lausanne, where he's carrying out comparative research on the interface between transparency and democratization. He did his PhD at the LSE, where he investigated and examined the political and social processes that led to the enactment of the Right to Information Act in India. Previously, he's worked with the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development, the World Bank, the BBC World Service Trust, the London School of Economics, and the University of Delhi. Chitrangala Chaudhary, on my right, is an award-winning journalist and researcher. Over her fellowship period, she's been chronicling the effects of resource conflicts on the lives of indigenous and marginalized communities in central India's forested mineral belt. And we've had a map of India up on the screen. That won't be the it's just an image for you to refer to as they speak. She's currently based in the Indian state of Orissa in the east, home to over 60 indigenous communities, rich forests, and large deposits of minerals, including coal, bauxite, and iron ore. She has worked at two leading Indian national dailies, the Indian Express and the Hindustan Times, as well as the Guardian US, and has written for publications like Outlook, Mint, Caravan, and the Columbia Journalism Review. She has been named for national and international reporting awards, including the Sanskriti Award and the Lorenzo Natali Journalism Prize. She has been a Fulbright Nehru Scholar at the Columbia University's Journalism School and the School of International and Public Affairs. So with that, maybe I could just turn to Prashant and ask him to offer us an overview. I know his fellowship work has evolved and changed quite a bit since our initial conversations, and so tell us a little bit about how your project has evolved and also how it relates to our question for today.
Well, thanks. It's been a pretty interesting and very enriching, very intense year and a ride. So the project started with the idea of looking, trying to understand the accountability question when it came to public-private partnerships, because most accountability frameworks, as we've understood them, known them, studied them, and read about them, seem to have been focused mostly on state accountability, governmental accountability. In other forms, of course, there's been discussions and a lot of debate around private sector accountability, particularly post the financial crisis and so on and so forth. But when it came to PPPs, there seemed to be this sort of gray area, which was, you know, neither private nor state, not completely. So it was this sort of in-between world, if you will. And there, a lot of the usual accountability frameworks seem to be unexamined. How are they working out? I mean, are they working out well? Are they completely different challenges? How exactly are we going to approach some of these questions? So initially, I started with public-private partnerships. I consciously didn't want to focus. Most PPPs are, as at least we seem to come across, are in the physical infrastructure space. So roads, ports, you know, the usual suspects. But in this case, I thought I was more attracted towards exploring the social sector, PPPs in the social sector, which seem to be also on the rise, and particularly education and health. And as the weeks progressed, and long, very interesting conversations else also in the initial part, but somehow it sort of started getting more of a focus on the education part. So that's been a very interesting. So in the end, I think for the last, the majority of the work has been focused mostly around public-private partnerships in education across a wide range of geographies. So it's been quite enriching, and I mean, there are many things, of course, which one could talk about, and I think it's difficult to try and distill all of that right now, also partly because I'm still absorbing much of the work which has gone the last year. But the one thing which one I found interesting, and perhaps that's something which we could dwell upon and link to this whole idea of the binaries, that I think most of the times we find that we are generally in debates across the social sciences and in various processes of social and political evolution, we tend to start seeing things in these binaries very often, and that's usually the typical entry point. So whether it's a public-private in this case, or it could be even, you know, the larger theoretical sense, left and right, and you know, the market and the state, and a lot of the times you're essentially working with binaries. Now that's useful, but is that necessarily sophisticated enough? And I think that's something as a larger question which I ended up beginning to question through the process of this year. Initially, I was myself sort of, you know, stuck in the same ways of, okay, yes, there are systems for private sector accountability, there are systems for public sector accountability, and this thing lies in the middle, and therefore maybe there needs to be a different kind of framework for things which are sort of lying in the middle. But then you start discovering that it's actually not just PPPs which lie in the middle. There's a lot of stuff which lies in the middle. In fact, a vast majority of social, economic, political processes lie somewhere in the middle. So how does one really negotiate this space? Because one enters it by saying, yes, you know, this is how we can try and make sense of it. But when we come to this large, diffused middle, a lot of these categories start falling by the wayside. So for example, whether it's let's take the example of a school in South Africa, and which is a private person takes up as a sort of matter of concern, social concern, who's had experience in the education system, starts working with private companies and starts setting up some schools on the outskirts of various townships just outside of Johannesburg. The resources are brought in from the private sector. A lot of money, now part of it is also rooted through this corporate social responsibility frameworks, and monies which they of course going to be, shall we say, trying to make the most of that as well. At the same time, you start, as the school and its results starts getting recognized a bit, the state starts coming in with some resources to support that effort. And next thing you know, it's a network of schools over it spreads over a period of several years. And in the end, there are many results to show for it. There are there is obviously an audience which is quite, it's focused only on the population in the townships. There is clearly, what's also encouraging in this case is that many graduates from these schools also start coming back after certain years and becoming teachers themselves in these schools. So there's this kind of loop also which gets established. Now, this is all very interesting and positive broadly. Of course, there are other problems as well, because what's the selection process? How are these students selected? On what basis? So there are all kinds of questions and critiques which are going around of that model as well. What happens though, which I find particularly interesting, is that when a group of people who are, whether education specialists or including the government or some people who are working in this kind of a project or bringing in some of this or the corporates, when that conversation starts happening about some of these things, the battle lines suddenly become very polarized. And that's pretty awkward, because yes, it's a project which is doing some interesting stuff, with its flaws and with many limitations, but with a fair amount of, the desire to actually make it work better and improve the project, improve how it's done. But when the moment we start getting onto a table or starting having conversations about this, it's essentially the line is a very straight one, that there's a group of people who will essentially say there should be no private sector involvement in the delivery of public education. There should be none, because it goes against the very idea of the rights-based approach, it goes against the idea of social justice, it creates more problems, and so on and so forth, with a set of, shall we say, evidence to support their argument. The other side, so to speak, is also coming up with its own set of evidence, which says, yes, there might be some of these things, but at the same time, this is how it's actually improved learning outcomes, and so on and so forth, and some of the output has been positive and interesting for these very reasons. Also, here are the limitations of the public sector, publicly funded, publicly financed, state-led education system, which is the reason why some of this thing has had to take place or had to be delivering some of these services. Now, on the ground, it's a grey area, which is where I think what we are most concerned about in terms of the students and the learning and so on and so forth. But in the conversations, it's no longer grey; it's black or white. That is something which, there is not a great deal of willingness to actually have a conversation about this, because everybody's coming at it from their. So you can have one set of people who are perhaps proposing a certain idea, is bringing a set of evidence which supports their perspective. The other side will bring in their evidence, then the argument. And this, I think, is true for most social science research, where a lot of the argument then starts getting into my research is better than yours, my numbers are better than yours, because your methodology is problematic on these X, Y, Z. No, but when you did your research and when you did this study, there's a problem there, because this thing is limited in this X, Y, Z sense. So in the end, it becomes a bit of a sort of, a battle which is essentially an ideological battle, but being the pretense of fighting it out on an evidence-based policy, research platform, which it isn't actually, if you think about it. Because that's the problem with the large gray area. It's messy, it's complex, and social science cannot necessarily say this is conclusive evidence. It will always be, the evidence will always be conclusive, because society is very complex, societies are complex, and it will always be, it depends. So is this the idea of this notion of, whether PPPs therefore are good or bad when it comes to delivering school education? The actual answer is it depends. But we are not comfortable with that it depends. We are always trying to say, no, we have to take a position on this. And then it's sort of a retro-engineering thing. So how does one get out of this kind of a thing? One way, some of the ideas, which at least we've been experimenting with some of my colleagues and in this during the course of this project, is actually to separate principles from ideology. So if the principle is, what do we all agree on? If all of us agree on that, regardless of what system there is, accountability is a key element of it, and how do we then realize that accountability? That becomes a principle. But if we say no, it has to be only the responsibility of the state to deliver school education, then that becomes that's our entry point. We only start talking about the accountability of state-led education systems afterwards. Then we are running into a problem, because we are not recognizing the complexity of the real world. So I think essentially the biggest question for me really is that how does one start rethinking many of these things without getting stuck in some of these binaries, without already assuming that the moment there's private sector involvement in any large development process, it is axiomatically bad, it is axiomatically negative. And how does one really start talking and getting conversations going across the board, which more realistically and more honestly reflect the actual complexity of the reality in most social, economic, and political processes. So that's really it. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll explore a bunch of that. Chitrangada?
Yeah. So Milap thought that both of us are in town and we should speak together. And we were trying hard to find how both of us can speak together. And he's used the word public-private partnership in the invite note, but I think what is a better characterization of the things I have been looking at over the last year and a half is state corporate collusion. The refrain I hear a lot on the ground from people I meet as I've traveled across this landscape, Milab will show the map, is, you know, the state is in the company's pocket. It's a colloquial phrase which I'm translating, but it means that, you know, the company has the power to influence the state, but also the state is in the company's pocket and it's eating some money there. So it's a very evocative phrase which they use on the ground. So the landscape essentially I'm speaking about is the east, where you see a lot of the green concentrated in the center of, so this is central and eastern India. These are all very resource-rich states, very dense forest cover, and like I said, lots of indigenous communities. So for reasons of both history and geography, all these communities have been marginalized from, you know, key development indices like education or health or access to government, public services. And that then plays a very important role in, you know, creating an arena for violence where the state and the company can come together and influence people's lives in a way which they probably cannot do if, you know, you're an urban Indian or you are a middle-class Indian. So you're much more vulnerable to this nexus or to this violence if you are an Indian living in these areas. So I'm going to speak again on 17th when I think Milab is putting together another event. But right now I just want to draw two, three sort of just draw the context with two, three broad themes. Development is a very contested term in India, as I'm sure it is in many other countries outside the Western region. We don't really have a word in our own language for it. A word which is used a lot is Vikas, which more accurately translates as progress, which is not really development. So development has been contested a lot, and this current government which we have now, it's been about 18 months, it came into power in May or June 2014. So the Prime Minister came, or at least that's how he marketed himself, as a man of development. And if you then start unpacking that term, a key definition of that development is the ease of doing business. Mm. That's how they define it. And that would mean basically that industry feels like the state is listening to it. Decisions take place much more sooner. If industry wants resources, the time period of transferring those resources to them is not too long. Our finance minister, who's one of the most powerful figures in government, he was giving an interview last month to a newspaper listing all the government's achievements. And one achievement he said is that environment clearances are just now given as a rule. So that is seen as, you know, an achievement. Obviously, there's a lot of violence which then goes behind that on the ground. But that's sort of the power balance right now. And this is not new. The previous governments also, especially since the 90s when India started opening up its economy, and we said, you know, there has to be a larger role for the private sector, for example, in mining. Earlier it was only public sector companies. And again, I think this is what Prashant is also saying. Are these binaries useful? Because if you look on the ground, both public and private sector companies are equally bad, mining companies. But there was a lot of nationalization, so now the private sector has a larger role to play. For example, coal earlier, only our public sector companies could mine, now even private companies can mine. So this has been going on since the 90s, and to give you a sense, I think some of you were in India on that contested spaces trip, so if you were picking up the newspapers or just speaking to people, a national goal right now seems to be growth. Again, you know, this is a word for which we have no similar word in our local language, but growth. And this is the focus of the business press, it's the focus of the national elite. We're constantly looking at figures. And so a lot of these policies get judged, are they contributing to growth? Or another key word is reforms. So when this government tried to sort of alter a land acquisition law to take away power of consent, a lot of the business press framed this as, you know, a reform-friendly government. So these are how the policies are spoken about at the national stage. Once you start traveling down and speaking to communities on the ground, obviously the picture changes drastically. So this is sort of the broad economic picture. And another parallelly, what has been happening is there has been a deepening of democracy. There have been formal sites opening up where people can participate, where, you know, earlier hierarchies are getting questioned. So there has been a lot of, there have been long-led social movements and protests going on. But over the last 15 years, there have been laws recognizing some of these. So now people actually have a formal space to put up their hand and say, you know, I don't agree to this. Or like Prashant's work is around the Right to Information Act that just turned 10 years old. So for the first time, you can get documents out of a government office, which earlier we just could not. A lot of the legal infrastructure was sort of a hand-me-down from the colonial era. There was an Official Secrets Act, which is still there, but that could be used by the bureaucracy to not share any information. Now, even as a journalist, I use the RTI a lot. I can file an RTI, I can take out documents related to a mining proposal, I can travel with those documents back to the village and, you know, question them and then bring out all kinds of discrepancies. So that's a really powerful tool, which even people have access to. It doesn't cost money. If you're below the poverty line, you can even get the information for free. The Land Acquisition Act, which again came in 2 years ago. Before that, we had a Land Acquisition Act for 150 years, which again the British brought in, which basically said, you know, the state in national interest can take over a farmer's land. And I mean, no questions asked. You can't challenge that process. So we had that for 150 years. It's just changed 2 years ago. There's a Forest Rights Act again, which came in 10 years ago. Earlier, the colonial state had sort of just cordoned off large areas of forest and said, you know, now the colonial state is the owner of those resources because they needed timber for empire building, laying railway lines, other kinds of processes. So again, that has just changed. So all these are creating a lot of churning and flux on the ground. They're creating contestations, they're creating, I mean, protest movements, a lot of state violence when the state is responding to this. And we have civil society groups also. Maybe some of you have been following the state's action against Greenpeace. Just, I think, 2 or 3 months ago, the state asked Greenpeace to fold up its operations in India. This is part of like a year-long campaign that they have been doing against Greenpeace. Again, Greenpeace went to court and successfully challenged it. So we still have like an independent judiciary, to some extent an independent media. So all these challenge the power of the state and the company. Company is a word which people on the ground use a lot, so I also use that word company, to, you know, implement the kind of decisions that they want and the power that they want to sort of be able to implement those decisions, which they all justify in the name of development. For example, Greenpeace was accused of being, you know, holding back India's economic development. That was actually the phrase used in the Intelligence Bureau report. So that's how a lot of these groups are tarnished or painted on the ground, and that is the view of the state, because they feel that, you know, we need coal. So why is this group coming in the way and trying to stop us from mining coal? But that's sort of the landscape right now, where it's really interesting. It's clear that one side is more powerful, but there are all these unpredictable outcomes because of these legislations created, because of like a long tradition of protest. So, and this overlap between public and private. So this is the stage right now, and it leads to all kinds of fascinating questions about, you know, how do you frame and understand all this?
Thank you. So I will soon open it up to questions, and I'm sure I can see it on your faces. There's already questions. But maybe let's kick off the discussion with one point that you referred to a little bit and that came up a little bit in your thinking about this. What you're presenting are two different sides of the broader conversation around the private sector and development. You brought up this whole notion of corporate social responsibility. Of course, in India recently, there's been a bill passed, a law passed that asks certain corporations beyond a certain level to commit 2% of their revenues to CSR. In the context of corporate social responsibility, where some of these worlds collide, I think both the worlds that you're to the collusion that you're talking about, as well as the partnership that you're talking about. So how is this playing out on the ground? What are the future prospects, and how the CSR law can or cannot have an impact in either making those binaries even more firm, or reducing, or, you know, promoting much more of the gray area that you're seeing out on the ground? So I guess it's a question to both of you, but from your vantage points.
I think what has happened with this new, it's not a legislation, it was an amendment. A lot of that money actually has not yet started being spent. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, the state has capacities. It's not like you throw a lot of money at a problem and then that gets solved. So I think a lot of this money still hasn't been spent. One of the public sector mining companies, which is in iron ore mining, they have spent a lot of money to build an education complex in one of the Maoist hit areas of central India, which has traditionally sort of not even had primary education. So they've built in colleges, they've sort of tried to hold that up as a model of, mm-hmm. you know, good PPP collaboration. So that
through the monies of the students.
Through the CSR money, which the Iron Ore Mining Company gave. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it actually is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, I would say there are two things here. A lot of the demands which people are making on the ground is about, you know, their resource rights. So you can't sort of give them money and take care of that because they say we need this land or we need this forest and the money will get over in 10 years. What will we do then? And the second thing is about justice. They say we need a say in the process. Again, CSR doesn't really address that. CSR is the state's way of saying, you know, we're compensating you in some way and we're making the company share some of their profits, but often that's not the complete answer to what is the problem on the ground.
Thank you.
I mean, it's interesting, but I think it's also it's a deeper question. All of these things, I think we need to keep digging a bit deeper, particularly at the conceptual level, in the sense, how have these things been thought about in our society, in terms of the relationship between, let's say, the private sector and people at large, or societies and communities and the state, and also what are the expectations which are now also, which have changed as well. I think if one looks to the pre-colonial period, a lot of the philanthropic work, or a lot of work around whether it was health or education or a lot of the stuff was essentially financed by rich individuals in that particular social community. And there was a certain social expectation that this is what would be, that's an important social role which ought to be played. Somewhere along the line, I think there's a lot of reasons, and I think that's something which we need to also discuss a lot, particularly when we talk about development, progress, and all the rest of it, that very sophisticated, nuanced, and extremely decentralized social, economic, and political systems were fundamentally destroyed when the Brits came in, and very quickly and very, very efficiently destroyed. Which effectively meant that there was, with no system, because the destruction was, of course, not just from the colonial perspective to extract, but also because they were replicating their own systems of their societies into a society which they were going to rule over. So these separations, these binaries, I think, when I appreciated the fact that Chitrangada mentioned that there are many words which don't exist in our vocabularies, in our languages. Development is one, many other words are there, but one particularly interesting thing which I discovered, that in Sanskrit there is no word for bad. There is no word for bad. It is always considered to be the absence of good, or the absence of. The negatives are not necessarily monolithic and present in social systems. It's the absence of something which is considered. So it's a very different, and many of these things are they're deeply embedded, deeply thought, they're diffused. So when we then suddenly come up with a system which is not germane or organic to the way society and interaction between what we now happily call the state and the private sector and citizenry at large, these are not necessarily dichotomies, or these are not necessarily binaries which have been completely internalized by people, or the social systems, which are essentially broken systems now. So how does one therefore, so then when we translate much of this into the whole corporate social responsibility, or some of these laws and legislations and the structure, even the legal structure which we essentially for the largest part inherited from a colonial government, which was therefore existed for a certain purpose, which is to extract, it's always going to be a very complex and very contested and extremely painful process, which may not necessarily ever reach a point where, you know, all of those things are internalized completely, because there's always going to be tensions. So the idea of the tensions between what is the role of the private sector and how is philanthropy seen, and for what things, what purposes it's there, these are all very, very they're culturally in some ways defined as well, and we cannot forget that. So so now with the CSR law, coming back to that, sorry, it gets, but it is a very naughty thing, so I'm just trying to see if I can get a flavor across of that. But the thing of the CSR law, it's sort of an obligation by the state for people to put aside. Does this mean that before this, private companies were not performing philanthropic activities? It's interesting, but ITC, which is apart from many other things, it's also the largest tobacco company in India. In Andhra, where it basically grows a lot of tobacco leaves, it's also called, speaking of which, the mother company. It's literally, in the vernacular, it's called the mother company in Telugu. Partly also reason because it's in those areas, it just employs practically everybody. But on another level, it was also consistently putting schools in place or healthcare facilities and so on and so forth as a part of its own responsibility, much before the CSR thing came into the picture, even the idea of CSR comes into the picture. The Tatas were some of the biggest conglomerates. I mean, in eastern India, you would be able to sort of, you know, they run some of the biggest schools, hospitals, and so on and so forth. So there's also Tata Institute of Social Sciences, which is another thing which is probably some of you might have come across his work in Mumbai. So just to say that I think if you talk to many people, different people about, it's one thing to start framing the discussion, you know, this is a CSR responsibility, what are you going to do with it? And where is the money going? And you know, these are all very real, practical, nitty-gritty, granular things. And yes, there's also critiques that the CSR money is going to take away people from the NGO sector because the number of people who are qualified, they're going to pay better. There's all kinds of criticism around, sure. But how are these, what is the role? I think eventually we'll have to develop a better understanding of how are these relationships imagined? The relationship between a big company, the state, citizen groups, societies, communities. And what is the general social expectation from this? And how are these panning out? I think till we start getting to those deeply philosophical questions, we will always be focusing on all the lived out tensions, which are important, but we're not going deeper. We're not going deep enough.
Thank you. With that, I'm going to open it up. Else? No?
Yeah, of course not.
Yeah, thank you so much for a very thought-provoking comment. And at Public Health Program, we have engaged over the past couple of months in a strategy around governance for health and many of these issues. Because, as you were saying earlier, health is a sector where this whole debate about public and private and public-private partnerships, etc., is very prominent. And what was interesting in our discussions about what is wrong and what do we want to do around that is that we felt that the whole dichotomy between public and private, it doesn't make sense, and both of you have spoken to that from different angles, and I'm wondering whether we would expect the state to defend the public interest. I think we all have many examples where that is not at all the case. And the private sector, I mean, the Gates Foundation is the private sector. They are, we are the private, no, of course. I mean, but I'm talking about health. The Soros Foundation is not so active in funding health, but the Gates Foundation is one of the biggest funders of the World Health Organization. Bill Gates gives the keynote to the World Health Assembly where all ministers of health assemble every year. What does that tell us about the role of public and private? And so I'm wondering, shouldn't we come up with a much better terminology and semantics? Because I think it's a sterile discussion, as far as I'm concerned, whether public or private sector, because it doesn't mean anything. The public sector, me as an individual, am I the public sector or my government? I mean, think about the Troika in Europe, how they impose austerity on Greece on behalf of which public interest was that again? I mean, so I think, but we were stuck into this semantics, and I think it stops us from having a real conversation about what we need to have, which is about power, representation, accountability, and relationships. But I think people need to come up with new terminology, because now it's kind of like, it doesn't, it doesn't allow us to talk about what is really going on, let alone where we wanna be. And so I'm throwing the challenge, certainly the scholars, but also the journalists, it's kind of like, I think we really need to evolve our thinking because we get stuck in our old paradigm that is no longer applicable.
Do you want to have any responses to that, or?
Yeah, sure. Or do you want to take questions first? How do you?
Sure. Yeah, I can. Yeah, why don't we fold that into? But I mean, there's a question of semantics that I think both of you should return to at some point. Maria,
I'm following a little bit along those lines because when I was hearing all of this, the bottom line for me was accountability, and how. At the end of the day, whichever actor is acting, whether it's public or private, are they held up to some sort of accountability? And do they care if actually something is presented to them as something that they might be doing that is negatively impacting the public? And so even when you're talking, and you're talking specifically about India, but I you can say the same thing in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's inherent in the system that has both state and the private sector as actors, but at the end of the day, whether it's a public-private partnership, whether it's just the private sector doing something, whether it's just the government doing something, what influences them to act in a more egalitarian, just manner?
Please. Thank you, Prashant, for that presentation. And actually, I have one question and one comment. So the thing is, when you said about this binaries, I think often as a civil society, I thought that the entry point for us is the stewardship role of the state in terms of regulating the private sector. So, I mean, unless we emphasize on that stewardship role, I do not think private sector will ever be accountable to the public concern. So even when considering that binaries are too acute occasionally, what is your opinion on actually seeing state as a primary, you know, driver for regulation of the private sector agenda? And the second is, now this might be a bit provocative comment, but I think somewhere the beginning of public oversight on public services is largely a manifestation of aspirational middle class moving away from social agenda. That is the context that you can clearly read in India, at least. I mean, I'm coming from Pune and Mumbai, and we used to have such a strong trade unions, and none of those trade unions now are existing. This might be a bit insulting, but I feel middle class has actually emerged as the strongest cheerleader of privatization. Mm-hmm. And, once that vocal mass has moved away from the otherwise domains of activism and influencing public decisions and other things, largely it has remained restricted to paid NGOs with little bit of influence of occasionally people's organizations like, say, Narmada Bacha Andolan, or for that matter, a couple of organizations in Odisha. But, you know, mobilizing marginalized community and actually emphasizing their agency has always been difficult in Indian context. So how you are going to negotiate, that is the key question.
Prashant, first,
there was a
question. Is it related to this, or should we address these at the turn to you?
I mean, there are some connections, yeah, but...
Why don't you go ahead?
I was just going to say, in terms of... in thinking about public and private, might be worthwhile to think about in terms of the mechanisms that they ideally operate with, right? So we think of the private sector as operating with exit, voting with our feet, right? And so there's always a question of, under what conditions is that a meaningful form of power, the ability to exit, and that the public sector operates with voice, right? So people who are subject to the private sector have a meaningful voice. Now, of course, in the real world, both of these are kind of intertwined in many ways, both in the public and the private sphere. So the binaries are less about the demarcations between the spheres as it is the mechanisms through which those who are subject to the decisions can operate or can respond. Right, and so And I'm raising this because I was thinking about it in the context of when you said roles. The roles for different partners require political imagination, and before there's to settle them. I don't think they're ever actually settled in any society. I mean, I think these boundaries are always contested. I mean, in well-institutionalized societies, you have contests over the role of companies, the private sector and the public sector. You know, say healthcare in Sweden, for example, right, which would seem like a settled question. And I think like the idea that we can reach some equilibrium point might not be a useful orienting position. Rather, one which just empowers people who are subject, who are affected by these decisions, to be part of the conversation about the actions. And so I guess it's a question of accountability, but thinking about what those mechanisms would actually be.
Loads of things. I'll try to touch upon. So these are interrelated. So if I'm not able to respond specifically to your particular question, maybe we can continue our conversation outside after the event. I think the language issue is really key. I really completely agree with you there. And sometimes, I mean, and this may be possibly, I think, and these are interrelated, the accountability question and then the notion of the stewardship, you know, role of the state and civil society. We have to go back, I think, and again try to see how did we even, what, is there not a certain, part of the reason why we're finding this vocabulary difficult to come up with is because it is monochromatic. This is the, I think, fundamentally, and part of the reason it's monochromatic is because there are certain things on even the progressive side which have become very dogmatic. And for example, even the and this is probably heretical in many contexts to say something like that, but the notion of the rights-based approach, I think it leads, the moment our entry point is that, we are setting ourselves up for conflict because rights at the individual level are always going to be in conflict with another person's rights. And then we need an external arbiter to actually decide whose right is stronger in any particular. So then we are in some ways outsourcing conflict resolution to a third party. Because you've internalized the idea that, so for example, where my freedom of speech versus somebody else's freedom of religion, which is a classic thing which is going on right now. And it's at the individual level. It's at the saying that, you know, I should be able to say whatever I want to say, while the other party is saying, yes, but this is, you know, against the idea of my practicing my religion, whatever it is. We know we're seeing this every day playing itself out. And it's, so in some ways, the moment our entry point into thinking of society and social systems and therefore political and legal systems, the entry point becomes individual rights, which is, of course, something which we cannot, in this current context, ever say, ever question. We're also setting up ourselves for a different kind, a conflict of a certain kind, which is playing itself out. So therefore, is it even possible to imagine a different way of understanding social structures and processes, and therefore these relationships, the public and private and so on and so forth. So, for example, if I can imagine, I don't think he expressly spoke about the idea of rights, but if one was to think about the Gandhian way of looking at things, it would not, the entry point would not necessarily be the individual being the sort of, you know, the holder of individual rights as being the only way of looking at society or understanding society, but more in terms of the idea of trusteeship, perhaps, or responsibility, and social and community, and but that's looked from a community perspective, not necessarily at the individual level. But we are working now with where so it's bound to be that vocabulary is going to be limited, because that vocabulary comes from a particular cultural and social history, which is not the only singular cultural and social history of the world. It is not. So on the one hand, we want plurality, because that's what we advocate for, plurality of perspectives. But when it comes to ideas which we think are the only ideas, then we don't really appreciate plurality of somebody else coming at it from a different perspective. So if somebody is plurality as far as is circumscribed by the rights-based frameworks where the individual is the entry point, then it's great. then plurality is wonderful. But the moment the entry point is, no, we need to look at social processes and systems, and we need to see the community as an entry point. And let's say all legal systems have to be thought through or rethought by looking at the community as the entry point rather than the individual, we suddenly run into problems, because that's not progressive and that's not... So this I think, is that rethinking. That's why this whole notion, I think, these are... In real life, that's how it works in many, many, most parts of the world. So how does one sort of, you know, the fluidity, how can that be captured? And I think that's the biggest challenge. And indeed, I mean, civil society has to be careful, but I think if you look at it, again, we come back to the vocabulary that civil society is, in many ways, what we consider to be civil society is again trapped in that same vocabulary. The moment it steps or tries to step outside the vocabulary, it's no longer even considered civil society.
So it's no more civil.
Sorry?
It's no more civil.
It's no more civil. It's no more civil. And even this terminology, I mean, really, if you... I think what I find very useful these days, particularly as an exercise, is whenever we talk about any conceptual ideas or any processes or social processes, I try to find a word for it in my own mother tongue. And where I don't find it, or where I find it a different way, it suddenly tells me that there are very different ways of looking at the world, and have been. And so I think that sort of enriches at least my thinking. If anybody's looking for solutions else, but I think thinking through these things is important even in our daily work, and also for an organization like perhaps OSF, which is making grants, also widening the typology of organizations and ideas and individuals and whatever else it funds, which is not necessarily coming at it, you know, it's not a template. It means more work. But basically the template, the broader template, has to be really made those lines have to be softened tremendously for, I think, processes to be more I think it's not as if the world, these things exist and it's happening. It's just that I think most of the times we are unaware of it, and it's just that for us to be able to bring it meaningfully on board and provide that space and that voice, I think that's important.
No, this is very...
There's really nothing left for me to say.
You have a different perspective, I'm sure, on some of these.
No, I mean, of course, I agree with what you're saying, and there's so much overlap, and the lines have blurred, and where does public end and private begin? But I still think, especially like in elected democracies, I mean, people are completely within their, sorry to use the word, right, to have expectations... from the government, like he said, of regulating, of mediating, and accountability. I mean, just to give a very concrete example, like this Right to Information Act, I can't go to a private mining company and tell them, show me your plans, but they have given those plans to the government. They want the government to facilitate that. I mean, the government should be sharing those plans with people, especially who live in those areas. So to that extent, I do think, I mean, the notion of the public is a valuable notion, and we shouldn't completely throw it out by saying, you know, it overlaps with the private in so many ways, and we don't find that space. And very interesting this point you made between individual and community. This Forest Rights Act in India, which came in about 10 years ago, that also came, I mean, just on the back of like 20, 25 years of like social movements and like protests, basically saying that, you know, we need to give recognized customary tenure to the forest communities of India, and they've literally been painted as encroachers in their own land. So one of the provisions is the village which has common property resources like pastoral lands or, you know, like a religious site of a forest or a mountain. So that can be recognized through community title. And that is one of the most under-implemented provisions of that law. The state is still sort of, you can drag it reluctantly to award a few individual titles, but community is, there may be like a real handful of examples where it's been done. So I think even probably the state prefers to not, you know, get into that arena. Tomorrow, if the whole village, like a community title has been awarded over, say, 1,000 hectare patch of forest, and then the company wants that, the state would rather not, you know, have
the
company have to pay huge amount of compensation or have the whole village have a say in what happens. So that's also there. But I mean, broadly, I think the notion of the public is valuable, and I mean, not being naive about the way power operates. Like you said, the real, I mean, the important thing is power, and the important thing is looking at accountability. That's we still have to interrogate these.
But we have a public sector that has increasingly embraced the interests of the private sector, and this is exactly what you were saying, and where then, for me the question is not how we name, like, whether an actor is public or private, but what are the drivers and the interests that are at stake, and then there may be multiple public interests. I mean, me from a health and rights perspective, that is what I think is the more important public interest, but the states often argue, no, economic growth is the more important, and it's good for us all. Now, what we, I think, have gotten to learn is that basically states and the private sector, especially the kind of the big private sector, the big conglomerates and multinationals, they have collided completely into what I think we call now the 1%, and all of us are the 99 other percent. But that, I kind of, that's where it becomes difficult to kind of talk about the public and the private, because the drivers of those are the same. It's a power and money and economic growth, and we are all grappling and trying to build social movements to say, well, that does not really represent our interests, because inequality has been growing ever since. Economic growth is there, but inequality has been growing even more. So that's where I'm grappling. Like, we can't even have a conversation if we talk about the public and the privates, and I'm happy to kind of preserve the idea of a public, but can we think about a public that really represents the public interest of, and I'm not going to say the majority, because we work on minorities and vulnerable, I mean, it's not about the majority, but now it has all been captured under the same, that does not seem to be representing the broader public interest. But I don't know how we can even talk about that, and that makes it very challenging.
Annika?
Sorry.
No.
I'm very sympathetic to what Prashant has said about the problem, and what all of you have also echoed about the problem of inadequate vocabulary, so to speak. At the same time, you know, I think we run the risk of overstating this problem, in the sense that, yes, you know, the colonial regime, and let's not forget that the colonial regime was not the first, within quotes, foreign regime in India. The colonial regime caused some amount of whatever cognitive, epistemic, whichever, philosophical disruption. But that disruption opened up emancipatory potentials for the untouchables. You know, I mean, well, the biggest, strongest champion of the rights-based approach was Ambedkar in India. And no points of guessing that he was arch critique of Gandhi and his idea of community. And in this country too, you know, I mean, W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King Jr. So let's not trivialize, I would say, the emancipatory potential that an alien framework of rights has provided in to indigenously oppressed communities of any society. Now, having said that, I don't look at the... I watch what Gates Foundation is doing very closely, not in the health sector, but in the agriculture sector, you know, the Alliance for the Green Revolution in Africa. And in my own work, what I've found somewhat helpful, I'm just sharing this, is not so much to think in terms of, well, what is the public or the private, the state, the market, the growth, the environment, what are these things doing? But rather to, you know, work with a somewhat, with an idea which, you know, one can say comes from John Rawls, which is simply to ask, you know, are spaces for participation shrinking or enlarging? And that shrinking and enlarging, you know, that shrinking, and there's no monopoly on who can shrink or enlarge the spaces. In certain junctures, it might be a private company who's opening up spaces for certain kind of, you know, wider reflection, democratic participation. And in certain cases, it could be the state which is actually shrinking, which is, I think, what Chitrangada was describing in her case. And perhaps, you know, if we like try and examine that, I mean, I would imagine that, you know, if growth is such a deeply popular sentiment that, you know, that the Indians want, I mean, that our current Prime Minister thinks or would like us believe that it is, you know, then I would imagine that you open the space for democratic reflection and deliberation, and people will themselves come and say, you know, hey, take away our forests. We really want just 10,000 rupees in our pockets, and that's that. So my simple, you know, that perhaps one way out of this conundrum of inadequate vocabulary is to keep our nose to the ground and see what are really the mechanisms which are being opened up for wider participation, and whether a specific mechanism enlarges that or shrinks that.
Any comment on that?
As long as they don't have a fight at home.
People have a fight irrespective.
No, I agree.
But just very quickly, this one person that you mentioned, I think now we have figures for India also, I don't remember, but I mean the disparity is really grown. I think in India now, the richest 1% owns like 50% of the wealth. Or
it's okay, 62 people in the world own more than 3.5 billion people.
So all this is, it's happening globally.
Yeah.
But again, you know, there are all these challenges, and we are questioning what governments are doing, what states are doing. I don't think in India we're questioning enough what corporations are doing. That is a problem. They're still pretty much, you know, the holy cow. They're seen as the people who are delivering growth to the economy. So the way, I think in America there's much more criticism, and, you know,
I would not
say
that.
I think relatively, I'm saying relatively, there's
the
more
growth is very strong here.
I mean, here in fact the lobby, I mean, come on,
no,
the
that is there. I'm saying
on.
I mean, in terms of public discourse, it's not like you can blank out news on one or two industrial houses the way you can do in India. You just can't print something about, you know, the three top business companies.
It's the same thing, I think, pretty much.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that's
yeah.
big money. In any case. I don't think that's that. No, I mean, yeah, just one minor, something specifically about the accountability question, which is, of course, I think, key to not only the larger, I mean, definitely is key to my work. So you're absolutely right, but I think that's where perhaps even expanding that notion of accountability also, because currently most of our thinking around accountability is legislation and regulation.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a major limitation. It's a major limitation because that's what I'm saying. I think it's important to look at historically and in other societies, in different societies, and in large parts of the world, how is accountability exercised and realized? Because every society, it is. In a certain fashion, it may not necessarily be in a manner which is formalized in the sense what we consider to be formalized, which is perhaps through legislation, regulation, and, you know, have rule of law broadly. But there are many, many, many different forms in which that is realized, whether it's through the idea of social expectation and what somebody is supposed to be doing or not doing, and what is the right thing, and many of these things also again relate to what are the administrative structures, how decentralized a particular even the administrative rules are, in what forms and ways. There are so many things which are deeply integrated, and that's where, again, particularly I find when I think about in many post-colonial societies, is the destruction of forms and systems of social accountability, which were brought in by essentially a colonial power. And there, Aniket, I disagree with you. I think there's a huge difference between the British as a colonial thing and previous whatever, massive difference, and we can discuss that maybe not to bore everybody. It's not quite along the same, you know, happy continuum. But that's the destruction, I think, is I think that's key. And not to say, you know, one wants to sort of, you know, start looking at some great golden period in the ancient past and all the rest of it, not to say that, but I think recognizing that a lot of the problems we are running into now, or the tensions and the conflicts and the seemingly sort of, you know, the it lies, it's there because of very specific historical reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Just to follow up points, I mean, when I think of accountability and why perhaps the United States is a little bit better, is because there's a lot of public opinion, and public opinion seems to count. And so that on some level, whether you're a corporate or NGO or the government, if you have bad press or if you've done something that's the subject of criticism, you know, it's either going to be you're not going to get a vote, you're not going to get funding as an NGO, or you're not going to get customers as a company. So I don't know if there's an equivalent strength of public opinion, let's say, in a place like India. Just that one thing. And then the other point was, you know, on accountability as well. And I think, again, the United States may be a little bit better in this as well, is the notion that, you know, if you're going to be the government and you're going to be holding non-governmental actors accountable, you better be accountable yourself to your public. So to the extent that you either show that through some sort of transparency or reporting or whatever the case might be, then there's some level of either hope or trust, whatever you want to call it, that your government is actually taking that responsibility seriously. And if you're not showing that as a government otherwise, then I would think that there'd be a lot of distrust that you're doing it vis-a-vis any other sector in the country.
Just to quickly respond, I'm not so sure. First and foremost, I think the moment we get into the vocabulary of it's better here and worse there, that's a problematic. That's a problematic because that does not recognize that things are different in different places, and that's all there is to it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's better or worse, because, for example, I could say, I mean, if things were so public opinion sensitive in the United States, I mean, Walmart. So, you know, I mean, in terms of the labor and all the rest of it, you know, there would be, and over the last 15 years, with all the bad press they've received and so on and so forth, and actually the profits would be falling, or they'd be, you know, going bankrupt by now. Well, it's not happened. So it's not. So I mean, I can also, we can all take examples, because we all. So, but I think it's a false. It's pointless to actually think in terms of better or worse. I think it's just systems are different, processes are different, and I think sensitivities are different. It's just that the forms it takes, what the forms and how it works, is different. What we, I think, consider to believe, to what we believe in, we want to strengthen those points. I think it's mostly that. And I think in many cases, that's why I'm saying, I think when we limit our imagination only to, let's say, things like naming and shaming, and which is what a lot of the rights-based discourse is all about, you know, naming and shaming, putting in a new legislation in place, putting in that legislation, and putting this regulation in place. Great. Nobody's saying one shouldn't do it. But I think an inordinate amount of energies and resources are orientated only towards such strategic such strategies and such activities, rather than recognizing that there are many other ways in many different contexts which are, if not equally, but even more importantly, effective. I think that recognition, and that's again, it comes back to the same thing, that how are we receiving our information or our understanding about other parts, is usually through the same lenses, through the same vocabularies, through the same dichotomies, through the same binaries, where we continue to hold one particular system better than another one. And that's where again we come back into the same problematics, and unless we in effect essentially think out of our own selves, we are not going to recognize that there are many, many different ways of doing things, and each has its own validity, and that is true plurality, not the dogmatic one which we, I think, we get stuck in one way of looking at things.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm just, you know, listening to this conversation, I think one thing I struggle with is this idea of accountability, because, you know, talking about it in the abstract is so difficult, where I think a lot of the question comes around, like, who are people accountable to? You know, and I think part of the problem that we're grappling with is that government is often accountable to business, but not accountable to the people. And that's the problem. So there's a certain kind, type of accountability that is there, but it's actually accountable for delivering growth rather than delivering something else, for example. And I think another one is, like what are they accountable for, and what do we, like, you know, what do we hold valuable that we hold people to account for? You know, and I think that, you know, the idea of, like, well, we're holding business accountable to what, increased profits, or is there something else? And I think our problem is that certainly in this country, like that is the main the standard, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think there's some debate now with this whole medicine scandal about, well, how far do we go towards that? But I think that's a question that I've grappled with as well, you know.
Yeah, and actually, if I can just, as an illustration, give a fantastic example. Many of you may have heard about this Martin Shkreli guy who had this company and hiked the prices from an old drug from $13 to $550 per pill out of the blue. Now, he actually defends that because, and he's actually today in Congress in some hearing, and he actually says, I am accountable to my shareholders and they want me to maximize profit. So I can maximize profit. I am maximizing profit. And actually, if I would have known, I would have done it. I would have hiked it even more. This is really interesting. And so the whole pharmaceutical industry is up in arms. It's like, no, we don't do that. Now, they do that all the time. They just don't say it like that. And this is exactly the question. No, because whose interest are you defending? And the pharmaceutical industry has always pretended that they are interested in our health, but they're not. They're actually accountable to their shareholders and they want to maximize profit and value in the market. Now, we are being confused, but I think this is such an interesting debate. And then the question is, like, where is the public interest being defended? And by whom? And where? Which kind of accountability loop is there to make that happen, which I don't have the answers for.
I mean, you know, you use your World Bank example, so, you know, if Bill Gates is providing how much budget of the World Health Organization, they're accountable to him. And then we talk about, like, you know, corporate influence, but there's a private funder to World Health Organization, and less and less accountable to citizens of countries who are, you know, less and less, contributing to the world. So it's all those questions that create that kind of confusion. Yeah.
That also raised a whole host of bigger questions I hope to explore more at some point. One last question from Sanjay.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a sort of
or comment.
2 minutes left. I don't know if it'll be answered. It's a pretty big question. But, I mean, isn't the sort of shortcoming of even our work is that we're focused so much on accountability, but accountability sort of looks at decisions that have already been made. Sort of, you know, it's retrospective. It's not reflective in the moment. So we never really, as an organization, you know, Prashant and I just talked about this the other day, unpack why people behave in the way they behave in the first instance. So the motivations for why people act in the first place, why do they seek power? Why do they seek, to be greedy or whatever? Like, I mean, there's also, and I mean, greed is linked to power, but that desire to do X or Y in the world, the motivation for why people do that, to my mind, is a better way to sort of get at these questions than the accountability frame. Because accountability, it's done, right? And the decision has been made and actions have taken place. And so you can sort of look at somebody and hold them to account for those decisions. But that thing which you wanted to interrogate has already been completed and finished. And you may hope that doing that will then influence how people behave moving forward. But we don't really see that in our work, do we? Like, I'm just thinking of the work that I've done with policing. I mean, how much do police change their behavior because they've seen the one or two cops that are held accountable for their malfeasance?
Mm-hmm.
It's not really, like, that doesn't really get to the heart of how and why people feel like, you know, knocking heads on the street is the way that the police will assert their power and therefore do their job effectively. Like, that is never really unpacked with an accountability frame.
Mm.
So it's just my one thought for today.
That's a big bucket of thoughts. Any final comment to that or to all of the other things that were brought up today? Chitranga, that do you have?
Very good samosas.
Who can we be accountable to for that?
I mean, that's always be after the decision was made, right?
Mm-hmm.
Usually
it often is,
Or like I said, like for the purposes of influencing the next decision.
Future behavior.
That's a transparency issue.
Yeah, but
because
I don't, I mean,
you're
that's
transparent in the process of making decisions.
There,
yeah.
Well,
I haven't seen that practically happen much.
Even if the process is 100% transparent, the problem is if you don't get the motivation or something in that direction, you have to know what's about to happen. and there's an infinite, it's like trying to micromanage employees. You need them to want to do the right thing, because otherwise you don't have enough bandwidth to make them do it. Mm-hmm. And institutions are way more powerful relative to us than employees.
Lots of food for thought.
Thank you.
This is a great discussion. Thank you to Prashant and Chitrangada
for
joining us today.